Thank you. Okay, well, as you heard, we're not going to have class on Christmas Day or New Year's. We will have class on January 8th, only I won't be leading the class because I'll be giving the sermon messages in the church. And so there'll be one of our other teachers will be teaching the class here. And just a word of prayer request. I'm asking the church if they could please let me do a Q&A after each of my messages, and if they'd let me give two different messages rather than one repeated. I like to do that when I'm speaking at other churches. And as you heard, the typical feature of this class is you can interrupt me at any time. If I don't finish my lesson, we just carry it on the next week. But that's one reason why it takes us years to get through some topics. So what we're doing this morning is different, where I'm going to speak, and then you can ask your questions after I'm done with my talk. And hopefully that's how we're going to run things on January 8th as well. But the theme is responding to the multiverse argument against God. And I'm going to give you a bit of a historical background on what led up to this multiverse. And the reason why I'm talking about this at Christmas time is a number of you have come to me and said, you've got relatives and friends who keep bringing up this argument against why, you know, explaining why they're not accepting the Christian faith or believing in God. And as we get into this, I'm going to be explaining to you there are Christian versions of the multiverse and then atheist versions. I'm primarily going to be responding to the atheist versions of the multiverse. And yes, I will define what the multiverse is. But let me lead up to what brought this about, because this is a new phenomena. You know, if you, all you need to do is go back 30 years, gee, even 15, 10 years, you were not hearing atheists coming up with this argument. So what is it that led up to this multiverse phenomena? Well, it begins with the space-time theorems. And this actually had a role in my coming to the Christian faith, is recognizing that physicists in Britain were actually developing proofs that showed that space and time have a beginning. Those theorems were beginning to be developed in 1967 and 68. Probably the one that got people's attention was the one by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, published in 1970. That's actually what launched Stephen Hawking to worldwide fame. He was the one, along with his research partner, that proved that space and time were created. Since that time, over 30 space-time theorems have been published, mainly because when that first theorem came out, you had physicists and astronomers saying, is there some way out, or we're not going to be faced with this causal agent beyond space and time creating anything? So they were looking for loopholes. And over the course of the past 30 years, these space-time theorems have been getting progressively more and more compelling and more powerful. Leading up to this theorem that was published in 2004 and 2005 by Arvind Bordé, Alexander Vilenkin, and Alan Guth. And the theorem says that any universe that expands on average has a space-time beginning, implying a causal agent outside space and time who creates space, time, matter, and energy. Now, the primary drivers behind this space-time theorem were Arvind Bordé and Alexander Vilenkin, and they spent 10 years trying to find a loophole, some way out where they're not going to be compelled to believe that there's this causal agent beyond space and time that creates everything. And they did find some loopholes, but every loophole they found would not permit the existence of physical life. And clearly, there's physical life in the universe. And this is what they said. Any universe that expands on average throughout its history, only those kinds of universes will permit the existence of physical life. So I want to be clear. There are models of the universe that don't require this causal agent, but these are models where the universe is not expanding. And any expanding, you need expansion for physical life to be possible. If you want, you can ask me questions about that later. However, the distinction here is this. This not only establishes that some kind of God must exist, it's establishing that it's the God of the Bible. Why? Because the gods of the non-biblical faiths say that God, gods, or cosmic forces create within space and time that exists for all of eternity. So it's God creating within space and time rather than outside of space and time. But that's what distinguishes the biblical creation model from the non-biblical creation models. It's a God that creates independent of space and time. Space and time don't exist until God creates. Now, I got a quote from Alexander Vilenkin. He was not a believer when he brought this up. He's still not a believer. But this is what he wrote in a book shortly after this theorem was published. The book is Many Worlds in One. But he says on page 176, referring to the space-time theorem that he and Arvind Bordé and Alan Guth developed, he says, quote, "With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning." And what is that problem? The problem is proof of a space-time beginning implies a causal agent beyond space and time who creates our universe of space-time, matter, and energy. Which is why the leading books that are now being published by atheist astronomers and physicists do concede that deism is something that can't be taken off the table. I mean, for example, Lawrence Krauss in his book, A Universe from Nothing. It's actually an ironic book because everything that he calls nothing actually is something. So, in fact, one message I gave in this class here is 9 different definitions of nothing, all of which are something. So, or I could have titled another way, Everything You Want to Know About Nothing. So, this establishes that there must be a God behind the universe. Now, when you read the leading atheist physicists and astronomers, they avoid the word God, but they do concede that there must be this causal agent that brings everything into existence, including the laws of physics. But that's where they stop. They resist the idea that this God that brought everything into existence actually cares about what's going on in the universe or does anything after he creates the universe. So they're simply saying, yes, there's this agent who sets up the physics, brings the universe into existence, but that's all that. And they don't even refer to it as a person. It's simply a causal agent. So, but what establishes, in my opinion, that it must be not just a causal agent who creates the universe and takes a 14 billion year long nap, is the fact that we see in the universe design. And this is really what the multiverse is attacking, the idea that the universe is designed for the benefit of life and as human beings in particular. Now, back in the 1980s, no atheist physicist or astronomer that I'm aware of was bringing out the multiverse argument. They had other ways of dealing with belief in God. What happened after 1980 was that the evidence for fine-tuning design for the benefit of life and us human beings in particular grew exponentially. So for example, in my office, I got about 50 books on what's called the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle, when we astronomers look at the universe, we see overwhelming evidence that the universe has been designed for life and as human beings in particular. And these books that are sitting on my bookshelf, 95% of them are written by people who don't believe in God. But they do concede that when we look at the universe, we see this overwhelming evidence. Paul Davies, for example, that's the second to last sentence in his book, The Cosmic Blueprint, that there's overwhelming evidence for design. And this is some of that evidence. Back in 1991, we came out with the Fingerprint of God second edition. And what I put in that second edition was actually a list of the different features of the universe that show exquisite design for the benefit of life. So for example, the laws of physics have to be fine-tuned in order for light to be possible. So back in 1991, as we went through the scientific literature, we found 17 different features of the universe that showed design that exceeded one part in 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion. I chose that number because that's something we human beings are not capable of. So it's basically showing there's fine-tuning greater than we human beings are capable of in 17 different features. But what I want you to notice is how that evidence is increased with respect to time. The last time we did a study, it was over 180. It's now well over 200. I'm looking for a group of astronomers. In fact, I found a volunteer, an astronomer, Chuck Horse, who's heading up a team of astronomers to basically go through the database I've developed and actually bring it out into public form. However, what you can do is go to this website, reasons.org/fine-tuning. That will show you the evidence and the citations, the documentation of that evidence. Reasons.org/fine-tuning will pop up a 300-page compendium showing you the evidence for design and universe. But again, what I want to emphasize is how that evidence has been accumulating with respect to time. Basically, illustrating the biblical principle that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we'll see for the supernatural handiwork of God. And indeed, as we've been studying the universe in greater and greater detail, we're seeing that evidence increase. However, this is typically where the books by non-believers stop on the overwhelming evidence for design. The universe as a whole. They seem to be quite reluctant to actually look for the evidence for design at smaller size scales. And I think I know why, because the smaller the size scale, the closer it gets to us human beings. If we're talking about design in the universe, that's so far away and so large that you can kind of keep God at an arm's length. But when you're talking about our galaxy being fine-tuned, that's a little closer to home, or our star being fine-tuned, or our system of planets, or our planet Earth, or the life on planet Earth being fine-tuned to make possible the existence of us human beings. And so this is something that our team at Reasons to Believe began to study in earnest starting in 1995. And here we're looking at the features of our galaxy and our solar system that must be fine-tuned, not to make human life possible, but simply to make it possible to have microbes on the face of the Earth for more than 1 billion years. You say, why did you choose 1 billion? Well, you need 3 billion years of microbes on the face of the Earth before megafauna are even possible. It's the bacteria that chemically transform our planet to make it safe for creatures that are bigger than microbes. So none of us, that explains why the fossil record looks the way it does. Creatures that are bigger than microbes don't show up until 500 million years ago. Well, it took 3 billion years of bacterial activity to chemically transform our planet Earth to make it a safe environment for bigger life forms. And so this table simply looks at what do you need for bacteria to exist on a planet for over 1 billion years. And you can see that the number of features that needed to be fine-tuned that we could comb from the scientific literature back in 1995, 41 features, whereas in end of 2006, it was 676. And what you see on the right is the probability that these different features would be what they are with the fine-tuning that's necessary for these bacteria to possibly exist without invoking supernatural fine-tuning design after the cosmic creation event. So this table is really documenting, is the causal agent involved after the cosmic creation event? And this shows you that the evidence that it's supernatural or not supernatural, less than 1 chance in 10 to the 556th power. Now, you'll also see at reasons.org/fine-tuning, we look at this accumulating evidence in the context of bacteria that hang around for 90 days or less, the fine-tuning evidence drops down to about 1 part in 10 to the 300th power. If you only want bacteria to hang around for 3 months or less, it jumps up by another 250 zeros between the decimal point and the one. If you want bacteria to hang around for a long time, and if you want animals and plants, it jumps up. If you want human beings, it jumps up even more. So if you want something like the equivalent of human beings, it's less than 1 chance in 10 to the 1,050th power. Now, that's 1,050 zeros after the one. To put that in some kind of context, if you were to add up the total number of protons and neutrons in the universe, that's 10 to the 79. So we're talking about a number way bigger than the number of protons and neutrons in the universe. Or to put a handle on it, the probability that all this happens without God's personal intervention after the cosmic creation event, that's more remote than the probability that one of you here in this room would win the California lottery 150 consecutive times, where you buy just one ticket each time. That's how remote that probability is. Or as a mathematician friend of mine put it, it's the same probability of winning the California lottery 150 consecutive times where you don't buy any tickets at all. But if you actually look at this last column, what you're seeing here is that the evidence that God is supernaturally involved in designing our Milky Way galaxy and our solar system for the benefit of life here on planet Earth, even primitive life, it rises by more than a factor of 1,000 times per month. Which is why when I speak on university campuses to skeptics, I say, if you're not persuaded today, wait 1 month and see what happens. And actually, over the course of the past 15 years, it's been rising by about a factor of 1 million times per month. Now, this is what's motivated the multiverse. Because my colleagues who are not believers look at this and say, what are we going to do? This really is overwhelming evidence, not just for deism, it's overwhelming evidence for theism. And matter of fact, this is the point made by Roger Penrose. He was the research partner of Stephen Hawking that produced the first of the space-time theorems. And what happened a few years ago is Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, who have been lifelong friends and research partners, said, how about if we do a class, a graduate-level class, at Cambridge, where you defend deism and I defend theism. And so it was basically a class called God and Physics. And they've actually wound up, the whole thing got recorded, and they wound up publishing a book. Neither one of them is a Christian, but Penrose defended theism and Hawking defended deism. And when you look at what Penrose contributed, he cited this evidence, basically saying it can't just be deism. It's got to be theism. There's obviously purpose behind the universe, and that implies there's purpose for us. He says, I have no idea what that purpose is, but clearly there's purpose here. I'd actually argue you can look at the evidence and figure out what the purpose is, but that's another story. But this is what caused those people who resisted the idea that God was actually designing everything for a specific benefit, and indeed there is purpose for the universe, and hence purpose for human beings, to invent the multiverse. Now, the multiverse is an attempt to explain away all this fine-tuning design without invoking God. And it's basically saying there's not just one universe. There's an infinite number of universes. Moreover, every universe is different from every other universe. And with an infinite number of universes, where each one of them is distinct from all the other universes, then we're going to find one of those universes that will have all the fine-tuned characteristics by pure chance. That explains why it's possible for life to exist in the universe. So it's not God designing the universe, it's the multiverse. And by pure chance, one of those infinite number of universes. Now, actually, you require an infinite number of an infinite number of universes. Because take any one of these design features, there's an infinite number of values that one feature could have. And so you really need an infinite number of an infinite number of universes where all of them are distinct from one another in order to explain away all this design without invoking God's personal supernatural intervention. So it's not God designing the universe, the multiverse did it, okay? We happen to live in the lucky universe that allows intelligent life to exist. We don't have to invoke God's design. As long as we have an infinite number of universes, that takes care of it. Okay, now, what I'm gonna do is give you 8 responses to the multiverse model. And so when someone asks you about the multiverse this Christmas season, say, hey, I don't think God came to planet Earth here to save us all from our sins. We simply live in a multiverse. And I'm sure this Christmas season, you're gonna run into somebody who'll say that. I'm gonna try to equip you how to respond. Okay, first of all, even if you believe in this multiverse idea, that there's an infinite number of universes where they're all different, God's design is needed to explain why the infinity of universes manifest all possible cosmic laws and cosmic features. Okay? All multiverse models are subject to the space-time theorems. And so those that are promoting the multiverse recognize they don't really get rid of God. They're still stuck with the deism. What they're trying to do is get rid of the theism. But here's the problem. You can have an infinite number of universes where they're all identical. Who says they all have to be different? And so if you're trying to explain why these universes all are distinct and why you have every possible combination of the values of the laws of physics and features of the universe represented, that sounds like you need an intelligent being to actually design the universe so that that happens. So it doesn't really explain away God. He's still very much involved just to make this multiverse work. Number 2, notice that the atheistic version of the multiverse was not proposed until the evidence for fine-tuning design became ubiquitous and overwhelming. Okay? Back in the 1980s, when I was speaking on university campuses, I told people the multiverse is coming. So this fine-tuning evidence is getting stronger and stronger with every month that goes by. It won't be long before the atheists have nowhere else to go but to propose an infinite number of universes where they're all different to explain away the design. And I remember talking to the atheists at that time. They said, oh no, we're not going to do that. Well, that's exactly what's happened. They've been boxed into a corner where they've got no other option except to propose the multiverse. So in one sense, it's a concession to how powerful the fine-tuning evidence has become for the existence of God and the involvement of God that atheists have been forced to appeal to a multiverse. So back in the 1970s, 80s, back in the previous century, they didn't go there because they recognized that was really not a very good argument for their atheistic position. And they preferred other arguments, but those arguments went out the window, and so now they're proposing this. So the timing of the multiverse is significant. They didn't propose it until they had no other option. Number 3, what they did is they borrowed a Christian principle. I mentioned earlier, there are Christian versions of the multiverse. It goes back to the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, you had Christian theologians saying, we worship an infinite God. Nothing less than an infinite universe would befit an infinite God. And so there's a debate in the medieval times amongst Roman Catholic priests in particular. Is the universe infinite or is it not infinite? And it all settled down, well, does it really? They all agreed that God is infinite, but they said, is it really follow that an infinite universe only befits an infinite God? Some said yes, some said no. But I find it ironic that you've got atheists today borrowing a Christian principle to try to defend their atheism. And as I mentioned already, they don't really get rid of God because of the space-time theorems. All multiverse models are subject to the space-time theorems. So they're still stuck with this God. The question then becomes, how involved is this God? And I think that's helpful when you meet people who appeal to the multiverse, saying, well, this doesn't really get rid of God. What we're really talking about is the degree to which God is involved and how powerful God is. Let's talk about that. Okay. I think one of the more problematic things for the atheistic version, or I should say the deistic version, because there is no atheistic version of the multiverse. There's only a deistic version of the multiverse. But they explain too much. So for example, if you're going to appeal to an infinite number of universes where every conceivable characteristic of the laws of physics and the characteristics of the universe and our galaxy and our planet Earth and every life form that's ever existed shows up by pure chance, that not only explains away the fine-tuning design of God, it explains away the fine-tuning design of every human being. So for example, I could look at this space-time theorem that Stephen Hawking published in 1970 and said, Stephen, you didn't produce this. This didn't come from your mind. The multiverse did this. Okay, how do you work that out? Okay, if you're going to appeal to an infinite number of universes, you're going to wind up with an infinite number of planets just like Earth. And on that infinite number of planets just like Earth, you're going to have an infinite number of trees with an infinite diversity of those trees, and there'll be species of trees that shed bark that look just like the pieces of paper that make up this thing that we think is a space-time theorem from Stephen Hawking's mind. Moreover, in an infinite number of universes, as these pieces of bark are shed off this exotic species of tree, there's going to be birds flying over, dropping their droppings, and it's going to fall on these sheets of paper in a random way that's going to look like all the equations and letters that make up what we see there on those papers. So it didn't come from Stephen Hawking's mind. It came from the multiverse. The multiverse did it. And by that argument, you can literally explain away every achievement that every human being has ever made. The problem is nobody thinks like that. So you're basically exposing that the atheistic version of the multiverse is philosophically inconsistent. They're eliminating God by appealing to the multiverse, but they're not willing to eliminate their own fine-tuning design and their own intellectual creativity in achieving what they do. And so you basically can say, well, what you're doing is inconsistent. You're applying this to God, but you're not willing to apply it to yourself or to any other human being. Number six, the design is seen on all observable size scales and at all levels of accessible detail. So for example, I'm old enough to remember when we astronomers were only able to observe 0.001% of the entirety of the theoretically observable universe. I started studying astronomy when I was 6 and 7, so that's quite a ways ago. Okay. Today, astronomy has advanced to where we can see 100% of the theoretically observable universe. So, and what has happened is we've been able to extend the observable limits farther and farther away to encompass more and more of the universe. The evidence for fine-tuning design is exponentially accumulated. And this also goes to the other direction, where we go to smaller and smaller scales, where we're able to kind of examine the molecule and look at the atoms that make up the molecule and the particles that make up the molecule and the fundamental particles that make up those particles. So for example, we're now aware that protons and neutrons actually break down into 6 different kinds of quarks. But as we look at smaller and smaller size scales, it doesn't matter how small the size scale we go, we see this ubiquitous evidence for design for the benefit of life and human beings in particular. And so what's happening here is that you've got atheists saying, well, there's a size scale where we can't go. And this actually comes out of the theory of general relativity. Einstein, decades ago, made the point that if general relativity is a law that dominates our universe, then it'll be impossible for us to ever learn whether or not there's another universe. Because once you've got observers in universe A, the space-time envelope or surface of that universe can never overlap the space-time surface of another possibly existing universe. This is why people have said the atheistic version of the multiverse is not science, because it's impossible to observe the existence of a second universe. If God made 10, we'll never know. Because of the way physics is set up, the limits of our capacity to observe is within the universe in which we live. And so if God made 10,000, he made a million, he made an infinite number, we'll never know. So in that sense, the multiverse is not testable. It's not observable, which is why a number of my peers have said, this does not belong in the physics department. At best, it belongs in the metaphysics department. Or as Alan Guth, one of the authors of the latest of the space-time theorem said, multiverse speculations are not speculation, they're speculation squared. So there's just no ability. Nothing in science, theoretically, can possibly give us any information on whether or not there's a second universe out there and what the details of the universe must be. But the whole point is this. Everywhere where we can possibly look for design, we see design. What makes you think if you go to a size scale that we can't see, that that's going to explain away all the design we do see? And so that's one way you can appeal to somebody who's talking about the multiverse and say, well, wait a minute. Everywhere we can look, at every possible size scale, in each one of those size scales, we see overwhelming evidence for design. Surely the onus is on you to prove that where we can't see, it all goes away. Where we can see, it's there. And what you're really doing there is saying, whatever we talk about theology, we have to base our conclusions on what we can see and measure, not what we can't see and can't measure. I'll give you an example. I do not have absolute proof that my wife exists. All I've got is practical evidence. But everywhere where I can make observations and experiments, I see overwhelming evidence that she exists. However, I cannot eliminate the possibility that she might not exist if I appeal to that of which I can see or observe. You know, maybe she's just an incredibly sophisticated hologram, controlled by some agent existing out there in the multiverse. But it's kind of like this. I had very good evidence that she existed when I proposed to her. I had even stronger evidence when we got married. And now we've been married for 39 years, and that evidence has gotten stronger literally every year that goes by. But I still lack absolute proof that she exists. We human beings, because we're constrained by the physics and the dimensions of the universe, cannot gain absolute proof for the existence of anything. And I say that because, gee, it's about 32 years ago, I got to speak to a group called Atheists United. I quickly found out they weren't all that united. Because I began my talk with a question. I said, we're going to have a Q&A time after this is all over, but let me begin my talk with a question. How many of you would be willing to consider belief in God and the Christian faith if you saw increasing scientific evidence that God exists? A third of them put up their hands. And I said, how many of you would refuse to believe in the existence of God, no matter how much scientific evidence I was able to present for his existence? Two-thirds of the hands went up, okay? And they're basically saying, we will not believe until the evidence for God becomes absolute. I said, that'll never happen. There's no way I can ever give you absolute evidence for the existence of God. But there's no way I can give you absolute evidence that I exist, or that you exist, or that anything else that we can talk about exists. And again, you're exposing the philosophical inconsistency. The atheists I was speaking to were willing to recognize, yeah, human beings do exist, but they're not willing to apply the same standard to God's existence. Design is seen in all observable size scales and all levels of accessible detail. And so when we get a more sophisticated instrument, we see more detail. For example, in a few years, we're going to have what are called extremely large telescopes. These are optical telescopes that are more than 100 feet in diameter. It's going to enable us to see not just galaxies at the extreme distances of the universe, we're going to be able to see individual stars. I'll make a prediction. When those extremely large telescopes come online, we're going to see the evidence for fine-tuning design again rise another exponential step. And so we're already seeing to the very limits of the universe, but we can only see the brightest objects. There'll come a time when we can even see individual stars. We'll be able to see the firstborn stars. And but the whole history of science has been every time we push the limit of observation and investigation one step further, that's simply increased the evidence for design. It's never gone down. Okay, number 7. Atheistic multiverse models actually have been tested and falsified. So it's a mistake when people come along and say, well, because it's impossible for us to detect a universe beyond our own universe, then the atheistic version of the multiverse is not science, it's not testable, it's not observable. I'm going to show you a way you can actually put it to the test without being able to determine whether or not other universes exist. We can leave that as an open question. And I'm going to do that through this little analogy. I've got a coin here, it's an American quarter. And I'm going to flip it, and I'm going to ask you to call heads or tails.
Heads.
Heads. Okay. It came up heads. All right. What if I were to flip it a second time, and it came up heads? What if I were to flip it 10 consecutive times, and it came up heads all 10 times? What would you think about the coin? I said, yeah, a fake coin. You want to, you know... Does it have heads on both sides? Has it been designed in such a way so it's weighted that it always comes up heads instead of tails? Those are questions you would ask with just 10 consecutive heads. Now, what if it came up heads 1 million consecutive times? I think you'd be really questioning whether or not it was a fair coin. But if you were appealing to the multiverse, you could say, well, what if there were an infinite number of people flipping quarters that are fair, just like this, and they had an infinite number of people flipping those quarters an infinite number of times? The laws of probability tell you that in one of those situations, you'll get 1 million consecutive heads. And so instead of betting heads on the 1 millionth and first turn, you decide you're going to bet tails. But I would argue that's not a rational bet, because you've seen 1 million consecutive heads. And I think you can see the analogy. Look at all this evidence for fine-tuning design we're seeing. You're telling me that if we appeal to an infinite number of coins being flipped by an infinite number of people, that's going to prove that this coin indeed is fair? Well, before you bet tails on that 1 millionth and first flip, it'd be a really good idea to say, hey, before I put my money on the table, can I see both sides of the coin? And can I actually do some measurements in the coin, even if I do see tails on the other side, that show that it's been weighted in such a way that the flipping is not going to give a fair result? We can do the same thing with the universe, because what you're actually doing is examining this coin in more detail to test the equivalent of the multiverse or the infinite number of flips. So we can look at the universe in more detail over the next 60 days than we've looked at it since the beginning of time. And that's exactly what my peers in astronomy research are doing. I mean, literally every month, about 8,000 pages of peer-reviewed research papers get published in the field of astronomy and physics. Yeah, that many. It's amazing. And we actually try to read them all at Reasons to Believe. Or at least the abstracts for all those papers. But because of the amount of effort being put into advancing the frontiers of science, now astronomy is a bit unusual and it's advancing more rapidly than other disciplines of science, but every discipline of science, this is going on. As it says in Daniel 12, verse 4, at the time of the end, knowledge will explode. And I think, you know, at least from a scientific perspective, we're living in that era of exploding knowledge about the natural realm. And in that explosion of knowledge, we're seeing that the evidence for fine-tuning design goes up, it doesn't go down. If there's any credence to the atheist version of the multiverse, then they should be able to show us sometimes as we learn more and more about nature that the fine-tuning evidence goes down instead of up. Now, as you'll see in our compendium, there are places where it goes down. Why? Because we make mistakes. I mean, I'll give you an example. When we first produced our fine-tuning design evidence on our website back in the 1990s, we were taking the position that about 3/4 of all the stars are in binary, triple, or quadruple star systems, which would not, you know, it doesn't necessarily eliminate bacteria on a planet existing for a month or so, but it would be catastrophic for more advanced forms of life. And now that we know more about stars, because back then we could only really do this test on the brighter stars, now we can actually see really faint stars, and we're seeing, hey, we're wrong. Only 50% of the stars are actually in binary systems or triple star systems. And so we've had to push that design evidence down a little bit. But at the same time, 100 other features that went up. And so the question is a trend line. Do we see a trend line across all these different characteristics and accumulating characteristics, and which way does it go? Well, I've yet to see a month go by where the design evidence did not increase by at least a factor of 100 times. And I've never seen a month where it's gone down. It's always gone up. And so the fact that the atheist cannot ever show us an example where there's been a significant decrease in the fine-tuning design means, hey, it's just like with this coin. We're really showing that the coin has been fixed, has been designed to come up heads every time. It's not a fair coin. So when people say it's not testable, there actually is a way to put the atheistic version of the multiverse to the test and show how it's been falsified. But let me end with something easy before we get into the Q&A. And that's this. What these atheists are basically claiming is that this impersonal infinite number of universes produce beings that are personal. Or to put it another way, they're basically saying that which has no consciousness, that which is impersonal, has no intelligence, no knowledge, created animals that are conscious, personal, intelligent, and knowledgeable, which violates the principle of cause and effect. One of the principles of cause and effect is the effects are never bigger than the causes. Okay? Or you can just say thermodynamics. Because of the second law of thermodynamics, things left by themselves, without intelligent input, they run down, they decay. And we're seeing something here is that which is lesser is producing that which is greater. And so we're basically making the case, wait a minute, you're a human being, you're conscious, you're personal, you're intelligent, you're knowledgeable, you're creative, and you're saying all that came from something that has none of those qualities? Or what I'd like to share with people at Christmas time is that you're way more important than a star. A star is just a gigantic ball of hydrogen and helium gas. A star has no mind, no personality, no consciousness. And you know, your body is made up of 92 elements. So you're much more complex than a star just in terms of the chemistry. And yet you're personal, you're knowledgeable. And God knows the name of every single star. Surely he knows your name because you're way more important than just a star that's out there. If you want to read more about the multiverse, I've got it summarized in this book, More Than a Theory. My colleague on our Reasonably staff, Jeff Zwirink, wrote a book called Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? And what's good about his book is he actually shows you there is a way to build a multiverse model that doesn't have contradictions built within it. But only Christian versions of the multiverse allow that to take place. Every atheistic version of the multiverse is fraught with internal contradictions. So if you want to read something more detailed, you can get his book. I also recommend you get this book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, written for lay people, basically saying there's much more to fine-tuning than just making a home for us. The universe was fine-tuned, not just to make a home for us, but to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And that's something that's been missing in all these books I have on fine-tuning in my personal library. None of these physicists and astronomers actually look beyond the design to make a home for us, to look at the purpose for which we were created, the purpose for the universe. So as fine-tuned as the laws of physics in the universe are to make a home for us, they're much more fine-tuned in order to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And then a sequel to that is this book, Improbable Planet. Okay, I'm going to take the rest of the time for questions, and I'll take any question on any subject, but we are going to have a rule. One question per person per turn. If you got three questions, I'm going to ask you to take three separate turns. And if you don't get to ask your question today, then you can contact us on our Twitter and Facebook pages. Every one of our scientists at Reasons to Believe has a Facebook and a Twitter page where we answer questions. Okay, your question is first. And if I don't do this, because we're recording this, make sure I repeat the question. Go ahead.
Okay. I always thought it would be kind of funny if we were looking through a telescope at the edges of where we could possibly see, and we'd see Jesus waving back at us, you know, particularly to the scientists.
Okay.
But that's not a question.
Okay.
My question is about the multiverse. You mentioned Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. What are their views on this multiverse? Have they expressed them?
Okay, have Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking commented on the multiverse?
Yeah, do they believe that it exists?
Well, they haven't said as much as other astronomers and physicists. Penrose has made the point, he's been quite critical of the multiverse, basically saying, because you know his whole point is theism. He believes there's purpose behind the universe and purpose for life and human beings in particular. And he says the purpose that the universe manifests would argue against the atheistic version of the multiverse. But I don't know if he's ever said or written much more than that. It's people like Max Tegmark and Alan Guth and Lawrence Krauss who have written a lot about the multiverse.
Okay, but how about Hawking, that was my question.
Stephen Hawking, he hasn't said much. I mean, he does mention the multiverse in his books. But I haven't really seen him try to go too far down the philosophical path on it. He just says it's a possibility.
But it's presented as a fact.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you've got some physicists and astronomers who basically say, I really believe this. Whereas you've got people like Hawking and Penrose saying, you know, this is what's being said by our peers. So they're really not making a specific personal commitment.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
I see if it's a valid point. When people bring up the multiverse for me, I always contour and say, did you get that from Jesus? He said that, you know, more than 2,000 years ago. And I quote the verse that Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. You can't go there now, but you can go there later. And it usually gets them a little bit on a get back because, you know, I'm telling them, obviously, that they're borrowing Jesus' teachings, you know, and then talk about how this universe is running down. And so God, Jesus, has got to make a new universe for us. And do you want to go there? It becomes an evangelistic tool.
Okay. You know, what Dave is pointing out here is that from a Christian perspective, there's got to be more than just our universe realm. So, for example, the Bible speaks about heaven and hell and how a time will come in the future when God will have eliminated all evil and suffering. The universe will have fulfilled its purpose. As he spoke it into existence, he'll speak it out of existence. But according to the Bible, when that happens, heaven and hell survive, which means they're not part of the space-time surface of the universe. So when people tell you that hell is in the center of the earth, can't be, because there's going to come a time when the universe will no longer exist and hell is still around. So, and you know, the new creation, I go to prepare a place for you. That place is not part of this universe. And this is important. Separates Christianity from other religions. Christianity is a two-creation model. God creates his universe as a tool to eliminate evil and suffering while enhancing the free will capacity of those beings who choose redemption. And then the new creation will follow this creation, and that's the realm where God's people will dwell with him for the rest of eternity, where evil and suffering will no longer be a possibility. The reason why it won't be a possibility is something I describe in detail and why the universe is the way it is. Okay, at the back, yes. Mara.
You're number five. So would you say theism equals purpose? You have to have a purpose for something, basically. And deism doesn't. And under your issue five, it says explains too much, does away with, and I didn't get it all. But you were saying we can't prove, I understand you can't prove history scientifically or anything, but is there absolute truth? Can you believe, I mean, is it why? The reason is, why can't you say if your wife is here? Because we can't go outside ourselves to see, or can you explain why?
Okay, the question is, why did I say that I cannot provide absolute proof that my wife exists, or absolute proof that I exist? Well, because we human beings are constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe and the physics of the universe, it's impossible for us to know absolutely everything about the universe. And what a lot of atheists are doing are saying, maybe there's something that we don't understand about the universe where things are radically different. And that radical difference will explain away God. So, it could also explain God, but it said you cannot eliminate the possibility in the regions of ignorance that we human beings have that things are so radically different, it explains away everything that we think we know. And so they're correct. I cannot close the door on that possible option. I could argue it's not a reasonable option, but I can't close the door on that. To give you an example, we astronomers can look. The farther away we look, the farther back in time we see. And we can look all the way back to just a split second after the cosmic creation event. So, for example, I could show you data that tells us the state of the universe when it was 100 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the cosmic creation event. But that's where our scientific investigation stops. Moreover, there's no conceivable means of technology that we can develop that will enable us to determine the characteristics of the universe earlier than that time. Now, there are atheists who are saying that between time equals zero and 10 to the minus 35 seconds, physics is so radically different, it explains away everything. Okay? And I can't close that door.
Yeah, I mean, you can't say yes or no, but they can't say yes or no.
Yeah. But the whole problem is they're appealing to something which is impossible for us to know to explain away everything that we do know. And, you know, the main point is this. There are areas where we can push back the frontiers of ignorance. If we push against those frontiers, the evidence for fine-tuning design goes up. It doesn't go down. But, yeah, there are places where we can't push. It was Alan Guth that said, if we want to get earlier than 10 to the minus 35 seconds, we're going to need a particle accelerator that's more than the distance from here to a galaxy a half billion light years away. And he said, that's not going to be funded until the Democrats control all branches of the government. So, yes.
On the other end of the of our limit to seeing to the edge of the universe is our understanding of the small scale, which is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And that limits... tells us that we can't eventually understand everything
right.
on a physical basis. So we're limited both on the far distance and on the smallness. And this really goes into the, I mean, so it, this feeds into you're saying that our understanding is limited. We don't know everything positive. And that's a point that applies not only to the scientists, but it applies to us. As believers, we believe on faith. We have evidence, but we believe on faith. And I mean, I think that's the that's really what we have to go on when we go and talk to non-believers. I can't prove to them my belief. I have my belief because I've put my faith out there and I've seen it responded to. We don't get our evidence until we have that.
Okay, let me see if I can repeat that. and you spoke loud enough that I think it's going to get recorded. But the whole point is not only do we have limits when we go out to the extreme distances of the universe, we also have limits as we go into the area of the very small. So, for example, because of the quantum uncertainty principle, there's a barrier that we can't penetrate. There's a limit where we can't, you know, I mean, we can go down and investigate what's going on with the quarks, but there's a limit to how far down we can go. But the point that he was making is the one of extrapolation, is that, yes, there are fundamental limits that we can't penetrate. I don't know everything that can possibly be known about my wife. There is a limitation there. I think that's why God allows us to be married for life, so that we can continue pushing back those frontiers of knowledge about one another, but you can never push back them all. And with physics and astronomy, there are fundamental limits that the laws of physics tell us it's impossible for us to see what's going on in that region of quantum uncertainty, or that region of the first 10 to the minus 36 seconds of the history of the universe. But we have the principle of extrapolation. Notice that every time we've pushed back the frontiers of knowledge, we've seen that what we know in the region that we started with actually applies to the region that we've discovered. Or to put in a biblical context, the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. So there's a constancy to the laws of physics. And everywhere we push back the frontiers of knowledge about the universe or particle physics, we've seen those laws of physics hold. So, if the atheist really had a point that things are radically different in those regions we can't explore, then how come we never see a violation of the principle of extrapolation? And so, yeah, I don't know everything about what the Bible is communicating. But what I do know gives me confidence that I can extrapolate. I mean, do I believe there's going to be a new creation where I'll reside for all of eternity? Well, everything I can test in the Bible shows that what it says is correct and true. And I can extrapolate based on that. I don't know everything, but the principle of extrapolation seems to hold. And the principle of extrapolation can be put to the test, because there's always more things we can learn about the record of nature. And every time we learn more, we see that, yes, what we extrapolated from what we did know in the past applies to what we now know and understand. Which means the burden of proof is still on the atheist to show that the principle of extrapolation is going to fail. Well, why do you think it's going to fail? It's held up everywhere we've been able to investigate since the beginning of time. Moreover, the Bible tells us explicitly that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed, which basically says you can extrapolate. And here's something I find ironic. If there was no principle of extrapolation, then why do science? Okay, what's really caused science to advance as well as it is this principle of extrapolation. That, you know, the laws of physics are going to hold, we can trust them, they're not going to fail. And because they're not going to fail, we can make discoveries, and based on those discoveries, we can advance technology. The technology we have today is fundamentally based on centuries of applying the principle of extrapolation. Okay, you are next. And I'll come back to you, and then you. Okay.
Is there any reason to think that multiverse has to be infinite? Why can't it be a dozen or two? Or the way I see it is it just insinuated to explain everything possible the way it was done through our universe, for example?
Okay. The question is, why the appeal to an infinite number of universes? Maybe there's just 12. And not an infinite number. And that could be. We know it's more than one based on what we see in the Bible about heaven and hell and the new creation and the angelic realm. But why appealing to an infinite? Well, you have to appeal to an infinite number of an infinite number if you're going to try to say that the fine-tuning design has got nothing to do with God's personal involvement. 12 is not going to do it. You really are going to need an infinite number of an infinite number, and they're all going to have to be different. If they're all the same or some of them are the same, it's just not going to work for you. So that's the reason why they do appeal to an infinite number of an infinite number. Okay, I got, yeah, you are next. Go ahead.
One of the things that I'm coming across in talks with my atheist and agnostic friends, and I'm seeing it more and more in popular media, is, I guess, this flavor of the multiverse known as the multiple worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, where, you know, instead of a wave function collapse, you know, all possible permutations of reality just spin out into its own new universe. I find this is a problem for both denying the existence of God as well as the existence of sin, and that we have any sort of choice in what we do. So I was wondering if there's any sort of just evidence-based, you know, short ideas or pushback that I can give to my friends when we discuss this version of the multiverse.
Okay, what she's bringing up is the many worlds hypothesis of quantum mechanics, which basically says every quantum possibility be realized. If you got a many worlds, that's kind of where Alexander von Lincoln was going in his book, Many Worlds Out of One, where he's just saying, and again, it's a sophisticated version of the multiverse. Another one is where people are looking at the cosmic inflation event and noticing that certain models of cosmic inflation actually would have a very large number of universes bubbling out from the inflation event. Now, with that, we've got some possibility of making some headway. There are experiments that we astronomers are doing which are going to be able to tell us what kind of inflation occurred when the universe was 10 to the minus 35 seconds old. And so that might actually give us a handle on what kinds of universes can come out of the inflation, if universes come out of the inflation, and how many. It's such that right now we've got really strong evidence that there was indeed a cosmic inflation event. Matter of fact, you and I wouldn't be here unless there was an inflation event. Inflation is crucial to make physical life possible. But we don't yet know exactly what kind of inflation event happened. With quantum mechanics, it's much more challenging. Because of the uncertainty principle, it's really impossible to be able to eliminate all the philosophical speculations that are going on, and that's going to continue. But I'm trying to remember the title of the book. I've got a book on quantum mechanics in my office, which is basically, I think it's called Quantum Reality, and it's making the point that there are like about 10 dominant philosophical interpretations of quantum mechanics. And the authors of the book are making the point we're never going to resolve them all. Some of them really don't sound very reasonable. And they pick on the many worlds problem. They also pick on Niels Bohr idea that the observer, it does all the causality and basically makes the point that's got to be nonsense because our powers of observation don't do anything. Our instruments do it just as well. You don't need a mind. And I actually make the point that Niels Bohr was doing this to support his Hindu worldview. So it's basically Hinduism driving that. But where the book basically drops down is saying, you know, it's pointless to try to pursue the philosophy of quantum mechanics. Because of the uncertainty principle, there's boundaries to what we can explore there. However, where we can make success is being able to predict what outcomes we can expect from quantum events. So that's basically experimental quantum mechanics. And they're making the point that is secure, and basically advises us to stop trying to develop philosophy in quantum mechanics because of the uncertainty principle. It's just not going to go anywhere. What the book did not address, however, is I think a point that really does help give us some clarity there, and that is that the degree of uncertainty must be fine-tuned for light to be possible. If there was no uncertainty, there'd be no possibility for physical life. Why? Because the Heisenberg uncertainty determines whether or not you can have transistors inside the proteins of living cells. And if you don't have transistors inside cells, then life is not possible. And so we actually need quantum uncertainty in order for life to work. But what I find interesting is a degree of uncertainty. If you make the degree of uncertainty bigger or smaller, there's no possibility for life. So the fact that the quantum uncertainty degree is fine-tuned is an argument that God's behind it all. And because God's beyond space and time, He knows what's going on. It's just that we don't know what's going on. And we never will know what's going on. And so that's not very a good area to pursue theology, other than to point out there's fine-tuning there. Now, I forgot who is next.
No, hang on, Hugh. It's,
it's time?
It's my
all
time.
Right.
Don't disappear, though. Don't go away. Class is not ending. This is the official end time of the class. If you have child and child care, you definitely know to need to go get them. If you need, for some reason, to depart, we're just going to pause for just a couple minutes and then resume questions. That's just enough for time to get out of the chair and depart if you need to. It's not time for a discussion amongst yourself, please, because we would like to start quickly. And the other reason I'm pausing the class right now, Hugh, it is our tradition to give you Christmas cards and a Christmas gift. And so come on over here.
Well,
I have
four
cards signed by a number of members of the class.
With all of you.
And then to help you and Kathy have a more Merry Christmas, there's a very generous Christmas gift in here from many, many class members. And so we want to wish you a Merry Christmas with that gift.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So once again, I'm going to pause the class just for a moment for people that need to depart. Otherwise, we will continue until 1 o'clock. So if you need to depart, this is your chance. And just as soon as I see those people have left the room, we're going to resume with your questions. I know there was a lot more hands that were up, which is why we're doing a special extra half hour of question time.
Was Ross Holden.
Okay, I'll get to
him. He was the second one, and he hasn't asked yet.
Yeah, my peripheral vision. Thank you. All right.
Mom always liked you best.
Yeah. Ross Hoagland's going to go.
He Ross had his hand. Ross Hoagland actually had his hand off. I cut Ross Hoagland off. You know,
he might be eating.
He may be eating. That's right. If he's got food in his mouth, then we'll have to skip him here. Yo, thank you very much.
Hey, Ross, you're next up. My peripheral vision was not seeing you.
Excuse me. Once again, if you could end your conversations, as I said, this wasn't a time to start conversations, so I think the people that have gotten up need to come up. So, Ross Hoagland, go ahead and with your question, please.
Okay. Again, part of Einstein's theory of general relativity, the question was, okay, if you've got multiple universes, one way you could actually test the multiverse hypothesis is that if two of these universes were to make contact with one another, you basically have a very destructive event, which should be observable. And so it's one way the multiverse can be put to the test. My response is there are actual multiverse models that would permit that to happen. But if you believe that general relativity applies to all these models, then it will not happen. And so if the theory of general relativity applies to the multiverse, then if you were to spawn an infinite number of universes, say from the inflation event that happened when the universe was a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, then the space-time surfaces of those universes would forever get farther and farther apart from one another, which means there would be no possibility that two of them would come together and touch. Now, where the theoreticians are right, if they were to touch, it would be utterly catastrophic. What would happen is that the space-time surfaces of all those two universes would collapse into a singularity. Now, there's also a model where that can happen even within one universe. So, for example, there are physicists that have proposed what's called the ekpyrotic Big Bang creation model, which is the idea that there's a single universe, and the universe that we're in already, in fact, I've got an article coming up on our website. It's going to be posted on Monday, or worst, Tuesday, but I think we're going to get it up Monday, basically making the point that we now got very good measurements showing us that the universe is geometrically flat. Now, it's not flat like a two-dimensional sheet of paper like this. It's a nine-dimensional flat surface. So don't try to visualize what it looks like. It's not going to happen. Okay? All right? Not even the mathematicians who come up with this are able to visualize what it looks like. But you think of this flat universe, and there's a limit to how far we can look. In the sense that the universe that we see today is the universe of the past. Because the farther away we look, the farther back in time we see. And because the universe is expanding, the universe that we see through our telescopes is actually a whole lot smaller than the universe that exists today. Mainly because the universe continues to expand, so the present universe is much bigger than the universe of the past that we see through our telescopes. You look mystified. Okay. When we look at the Andromeda galaxy, we don't see it as it is today. We see it as it was 2.5 million years ago, because that's how long it took the light to reach our telescopes. And 2.5 million years ago, the universe hadn't expanded as much as it's expanded today. So 2.5 million years ago, the universe was smaller than the universe of today. So if I look away, say, 10 billion light years, the universe is a whole lot smaller back then than it is today. Okay, so one of the things we really don't know is how big the actual universe is. There's some models of the universe that give us a clue. The best models are saying it's probably between 500 and 1,000 times bigger than the universe we see through our telescopes. Okay, back to this idea of a flat universe. Okay, they say, let me see if I can find one of these that's a little bit foldable. Okay, I use this. All right, this will work better. Thank you. That way I don't have to fold your cards. It'll be easier for me. So here's this 10-dimensional universe. 9 dimensions, not 2. And we can see this much of it, or see this much of it over here. Everywhere we look, it looks flat. But it doesn't eliminate the possibility that actually there's a place where it curls in like that. And so it's flat everywhere we can see. But far beyond where we can see, it's no longer flat. It actually curls in on itself like that. Okay, what these theoreticians are saying, that means that this 9-dimensional surface, we're on the bottom part, but part of the 9-dimensional flat surface is actually above us in a dimension we can't explore because there's no dimension between the bottom of this and the top of this. But they're saying that if you actually have this U-shaped universe where the two surfaces are close enough together, you're the one that brought up quantum mechanics. This space-time surface is not a stable surface. It's fluctuating. There's quantum space-time fluctuations taking place. Now, these aren't very big. We're talking fluctuations that are much, much smaller than a trillionth of a centimeter high. But if you have this surface such that the surface on the bottom and the surface on the top is roughly about a millimeter apart, then that means that if you wait long enough, there'll be a quantum space-time fluctuation on the bottom sheet that will be high enough that it'll actually touch a quantum space-time fluctuation on the top sheet. And if that were to happen, the entire universe disappears into a singularity and a huge amount of heat. And then it's all gone. There's 3 verses in the Bible that talk about that the way the universe will end is God will roll it up like a scroll and it'll disappear in a fiery heat. And yeah, there are people who said that looks a lot like the ekpyrotic Big Bang model. So maybe that's how God speaks the universe out of existence and replaces it with a new realm. That could be. We don't know. Will we ever know? Not until God does it. Then we'll know. Because there's a limit to how far we can see. All right. Now, you're going to have to help me. I forget who was next on the hands.
Mark.
Mark was? Okay. All right, Mark.
Immutability of the laws of physics.
Mm-hmm.
Concerning black holes, and like the, it's said that by some that the laws of physics may be different in black holes. Does that support multiverse? Could it?
Okay, the question is, would a black hole actually support a multiverse in that, you know, at the singularity of a black hole, don't you get different physics? Well, what the black hole theorists are pointing out is that at the singularity of a black hole, the laws of physics, quote, break down because you're basically dividing one by zero. So everything kind of goes to infinity. Now, there are no black holes, however, that are old enough for the diameter of the black hole to shrink down to, quote, a singularity. Matter of fact, there are no black holes old enough where all the mass that's inside the black hole, mass and energy, has actually shrunken down to the size of the biggest quantum entity. So, in fact, what Stephen Hawking pointed out years ago was that, you know, with a black hole, it's catastrophically getting smaller and smaller because gravity is overcoming everything. And so the black hole is shrinking. And he says when it shrinks down to the dimensions of a quantum entity, like say the diameter of an atom or an atomic nucleus, then quantum mechanics will actually be able to overcome the gravity and cause everything that what got sucked into the black hole to spew out and become a white hole. So there's something called white hole physics, where it doesn't really go all the way down to a singularity. When it hits that quantum limit, then it explodes, and you get this white flash of light coming out from what was a black hole.
How powerful is
it? Extremely powerful. You don't want to be around when a black hole becomes a white hole. I mean, I mean, it would be utterly catastrophic. However, I don't want you to get too concerned because the bigger the black hole, the longer it takes for it to go white. The smallest black hole that we know actually exists, it would take 10 to the 66 years for it to go white. And the universe is only 10 to the 10 years old. So there are no white holes. That's one of the reasons why we know we live in a relatively young universe. We don't see any white holes. If the universe was more than 10 to the 66 years old, we'd be seeing white holes. We don't. So yeah, the universe is only billions of years old. It's not 10 to the 66 years old. But that kind of answers your question, is that the laws would break down if you actually got to a singularity. And that actually applies to the Big Bang creation event, where you read the theoretical papers that are really detailed on this. They'll say the beginning of the universe was when the universe was an infinitely shrunken volume or a near infinitely shrunken volume, basically saying we can't know for sure. But if it was an infinitely shrunken volume, the laws of physics would break down. And they're basically making the point the laws of physics only make sense once the universe expands from that infinitely shrunken state. So when do the laws of physics take reign? It's when the universe becomes a near infinitely. But it's possible the universe began near infinitely shrunken rather than actually infinitely shrunken. So again, we're talking speculation. We really don't know. Okay, who is next on the Q&A? You were?